Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. If you've lived in California for any length of time, you've heard about the big one, a major earthquake on the San Andreas Fault that's been expected for decades. The last time a near-magnitude earthquake occurred on the fault was the 1906 Northern California earthquake, but the southern section that skirts just east and north of the Los Angeles Basin hasn't ruptured since 1857. And the section south of there hasn't seen a major quake since 1812. The southern San Andreas Fault and the adjacent San Jacinto Fault were the subjects of a recent study published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Solid Earth. In it, researchers modeled 1,000 years of earthquake activity and found something both fascinating and alarming. The two faults meet up at the Cajon Pass, which is a vital artery for both transportation and infrastructure, like water and power to Southern California. It seems that in past ruptures of the faults, the pass has acted as a kind of earthquake gate, sometimes stopping the rupture from continuing, as it did in the 1857 Fort Tejon temblor, or causing one fault to rupture into the other, as it did in the 1812 event. Joining us to talk about this important study is the lead author, Lillian Burkhard. Dr. Burkhard is a planetary scientist and geophysicist at the University of Bern in Switzerland. She joins us from her home there now. Lillian Burkhard, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. We're having you on because you are the lead author of a story that's drawn a lot of attention here in California about the San Andreas Fault. And a couple of weeks ago, a week ago, like everywhere I looked on my phone, you know, scientists say, you know, fault has been locked for 1,000 years, you know, headlines everywhere. So I decided it would be interesting to talk to you to get to the bottom of this. So before we get to that, though, I'd like to know more about you, because you have an interesting path to becoming a planetary scientist. So tell us about that.
Well, you know, people always ask, how did you get going and doing all of this? And I've always been a very curious person. Like, I always wanted to know how things work. And I actually didn't study geology and geophysics initially. So I have another bachelor's degree in arts, multimedia arts. And I worked in that field for like 10 years. And I also actually was working as a yoga teacher, and I had my own yoga studio. And I sold that, and then I thought, well, what am I going to do next? And, you know, I was just kind of not really satisfied with everything going on in my life and just general. And I wanted to know more about how stuff works. So I decided to go back to school. And initially I studied, well, I was enrolled in biology. And I took a solar systems class in that first semester. And I met my professor there, Bridget Smith-Conter, who's also, she's a second author on this study. And she actually sort of picked me out because of my arts background to help with a NASA grant that she was doing, mapping Ganymede and the stress field of Ganymede. So I started drawing maps of Ganymede.
And just for our listeners, Ganymede is the largest satellite of Jupiter.
Exactly.
And also a really interesting icy world that's got all this weird tectonic action on it. It's a strange mm-hmm. place, isn't it?
Yeah, it has, you know, displacements that kind of are compared to the San Andreas Fault, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, they're strike slit displacements. And through our study, we sort of think that this is caused by the tidal stresses mainly. You know, the tidal stresses acting on the moon that would cause these kinds of displacements, that the tidal stresses would have been higher in the past, especially, and causing this displacement. So there's a mission going, a European space mission actually going to Ganymede to map that in more detail as we've had it before. So yeah, I worked on that, mapping all of that. And then it just turned into, you know, a master's and then a PhD. And that's how I got to do this study, because my advisor, she had funding for the San Andreas Fault. And also her PhD was actually mainly on this computer model that we are employing now to do this continued study here. So, yeah.
I'm always fascinated talking to people like you about the path that led them to their work. And it never ceases to amaze me, but yours is one of the most interesting, how you came at the sciences from the arts. I think that it's just way cool.
Well, you know, my father is an architect, or was an architect. He's retired, but then you never stop being an architect, right? So I sort of grew up with, you know, questioning everything, looking at the built environment in a different way, especially, you know, it has a lot of effects on us as people. And just continuing on with that, you know, the whole world and how everything is, you know, we live on the sphere and how it is all connected with each other. And I've always been interested in all of these kinds of questions. So I guess it's just a natural progression, but I still work in the arts. I still have other, you know, I'm not very linear in my career as other people in my field are, you know, so in that sense, I guess I'm kind of different.
Well, earthquake science is so complex mm-hmm. and poorly understood, really. I mean, we understand a lot more than we used to, but still, it's so many mysteries that I think coming at it from as many different directions as possible is probably a good idea.
I think so, too.
Okay, let's talk about your study. Just give us a brief overview of what you did and what you found, and then we'll get into the details.
Okay, so basically, we fit 1,000 years of earthquake history into a computer model of the southern San Andreas and San Jacinto faults, and found that the tectonic stress has now reached higher levels than at any point in that entire record. You know, the two fault systems meet at Cajon Pass, which is northeast of LA, and we found that this junction may act as an earthquake gate, so sometimes stopping large ruptures from crossing between the two faults, and sometimes allowing ruptures to propagate across both simultaneously. And right now, both faults are highly stressed, and their stress levels are converging in a way that historically we would say has preceded larger joint ruptures.
And of course, the San Andreas Fault is extremely well known, famous throughout the world. Mm-hmm. But the other fault that you just mentioned, not as many people know about it. And I took a bit of a deep dive down the rabbit hole yesterday because I'm kind of a stickler for pronouncing California place names. Mm-hmm. And I found out that this one's kind of problematic, that you can pronounce it. If you use this classic Spanish pronunciation, it's San Jacinto, like you said. Mm-hmm. But the locals there pronounce it San Jacinto. And then I heard a person said, oh, we all pronounce it San Jacinto. And I was like, oh, my goodness. So
yes, I've heard that, too. And it's always confusing to me. I never know how to really call it.
Yeah, I think any way you want to pronounce it is fine. I know that I decided to call the college, the college there that's named after the valley. Oh. So I said, I figure, you know, what they're going to be the ones. And when they answered, it was San Jacinto College, but she said it really fast. San Jacinto College. So you couldn't quite tell. So anyway, pronounce it any way you want, Lillian. But if anybody's out there from down there, we apologize if we're not pronouncing it your way.
Yes, I'm very sorry.
I wouldn't worry about it. So let's characterize that fault, though, because it's not as well known. Tell us about that fault.
Well, that fault usually, in, you know, when we look at the earthquake history of that region, it would rupture alone quite a lot, not with together with the San Andreas Fault. But in 1812, it did rupture together with the San Andreas Fault. And that, you know, would mean that this was a larger rupture and a larger area would have been affected. So that's, you know, from my modeling perspective, the main concern with that fault. It's quite a long fault as well, if you look at the area that it covers. But otherwise, I cannot really tell you so much about it, other than it's, you know, it's going through a populated area, which makes it very concerning in terms of hazard assessment.
Yeah, the San Jacinto Fault is like the San Andreas. A lot of people tend to think of the San Andreas as the plate boundary between North American plate and the Pacific plate. Mm-hmm. And it's a little more complicated than that. The plate boundary is the stresses are taken up by a system of faults, the San Andreas being the main one. But there's also these other faults that are aligned with it that do the same kind of motion. It's called a right lateral strike slip fault. So, for example, if you are standing on one side of the fault and it were to have an earthquake rupture and move, looking across the fault, you would see the other side move to your right, laterally, horizontally. So the west side of the San Jacinto Fault and the San Andreas Fault are moving to the north compared to the North American plate. So they are part of the plate boundary system, much like in Northern California, in the Bay Area, for example. The San Andreas Fault goes through the San Francisco Peninsula, but it's mm-hmm. also accompanied by other system of faults that do, you know, take up some of that plate motion, the Hayward Fault, the Calaveras Fault. So they're all related to each other and the plate boundary.
Exactly. But, you know, it's when people say, you know, it moves relative to the other in a right lateral sense, it can be in the greater sense a bit misleading, because both plates, the North American and the Pacific plate, they move in the same general direction, which is northwards, right? Mm-hmm. But the Pacific plate actually moves faster. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it, you know, a right lateral strike slip in the end.
Tell us about the different segments of the San Andreas Fault that you study, because it's a huge fault. It starts in the Salton Trough just north of Mexico, and then heads up through the Coachella Valley area, Palm Springs, then in through San Bernardino to the Cajon Pass, and then it makes a big bend heading through the Tehachapi Range there north of Los Angeles before it goes up through the Carrizo Plain and the Coast Range all the way up to San Francisco Bay, out to sea, then back on land a little bit, and then it ends off Cape Mendocino. It's a very long fault. So tell us about the segments in your study.
So we actually have a model for almost the entire San Andreas Fault system. But in my study, I just focus on the southern parts because those are, you know, stress accumulation-wise, the most interesting right now. So basically, we start at the Carrizo segment and then go down to the Borrego Mountain and Raleigh segments down south. So that's our study region. And basically encompassing the Cajon Pass, which is the most focus of our study in that sense. And the big ruptures of 1857 and 1812, those are, you know, the ones that are very quite well known and that we focus on, and for the stress accumulation that we see in the present. So when we look at this whole section there, it's one of the most populated areas in all of California. And that's also why we chose to study this southern region of the San Andreas Fault.
Yes, and the northern section, of course, famously had a big rupture in 1906, the great San Francisco, mm-hmm. Santa Rosa event back then. But it's been a very long time since the big ones that you mentioned, 1857, just north of Los Angeles. I believe that started in the Carrizo Plain, which would be like due west of Bakersfield, to kind of give people an idea where that is. And then it propagated all the way, the fault ruptured all the way down to the Cajon Pass, and it stopped there, right?
Yes. So since then, we've had some other earthquake, like the Northridge earthquake, which was a 6.7, and also the Ridgecrest earthquake. That was 2019, I believe.
Yeah.
And that was a 7.1, but those were not, that one was not on the San Andreas. It was in the Eastern California shear zone.
Yes.
So we did have some larger earthquakes since, you know, the studied 1857 earthquake. But yeah, the San Andreas Fault itself should have a larger rupture within that period that we've studied since then.
for decades, scientists like yourself have been telling us that, you know, the big one is coming. And when they refer to the big one, they're talking about a magnitude that's close to 8, which is a very large earthquake, like the 1906 event, like 1857. Yes. And how big was 1812?
Well, the 1812 Wrightwood earthquake was a magnitude 7.5. That, you know, from estimates, we don't really have precise measurements of that.
There were no seismographs, or we don't exactly know. Which leads to an interesting question, because I see, you know, like 1857 would be the same thing. We have these estimated moment magnitudes. And that's what they're called, by the way, folks. It's not the Richter scale. They're moment magnitudes now. How do we figure that out? Do you know how they determine, you know, what they estimate those magnitudes are for earthquakes that happened in the past before modern seismology?
So the moment magnitude scale that we now use, as compared to the Richter scale before, it's calculated from the area of the fault that ruptured and how much it slipped, and also the rigidity of the rock. So the USGS does a lot of, you know, trenching studies, and that's how they determined, you know, during that time period, that area of the fault would have ruptured and how much it slipped approximately, and then also the rigidity of the rock that they find there. So that's how they estimate these magnitude ranges. Whereas the Richter scale, you know, it measures the amplitudes of the seismic waves that are recorded on a seismograph. Mm-hmm. And it's that was, you know, specifically for earthquakes in Southern California. And that scale is less reliable for larger, like distant earthquakes. And that's why we've basically replaced it with the moment magnitude scale.
Yes, and as you said, it's the size of the rupture on the fault that really determines how big an earthquake is. Mm-hmm. You know, the depth and the length of that rupture. For example, I'm thinking back to 1906. That rupture went from San Juan Bautista, south of the San Francisco Bay Area, all the way up the north coast, nearly to the end of the fault. So it was, mm-hmm. you know, a couple hundred miles of rupture. And how long was the rupture for the 1812 event? Because didn't that go through the Cajon Pass?
That did, yes. But I don't have on top of my head of how long that rupture was, especially not in miles.
Yeah, but it's a long one. It's probably 150, 200 miles. And it's interesting in your study, this concept that the Cajon Pass it functions as some kind of an earthquake gate. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a bit about the Cajon Pass for a moment, because it's kind of it's a scary, interesting place. It's scary to me, you know, in terms of when this event eventually happens. And it is, you know, as we like to say in the earthquake biz, it's not a matter of if, it's when. Mm-hmm. That is a major artery for transportation. There's railroads go through there, major highways go through there, gas pipelines, power transmission, water, all this infrastructure is funneled through that pass, which was, you know, wait for it, created by the motions of the San Andreas Fault over millennia. That's why it's there. You know, it's like, and we, you know, engineers looked at it and went, oh, this is great. This gap in these mountains, this is wonderful. We'll build the highway through here. And so it's natural that we would do that. But that's a scary proposition when you think about the rupture going right through that.
Yes, it is very much so. And so we basically call this an earthquake gate because that's where the San Andreas and the San Jacinto faults approach each other very closely without directly connecting at the surface, but they share a stress field together. And we call it an earthquake gate because it can either stop a large rupture in its tracks or allow it to cross from one fault system to the other, which would create a much larger and actually more destructive event. And so what we saw is that whether the gate opens or closes appears to depend on how similarly stressed the two faults are at the time. So when both carry comparably like high stresses, it's favorable to a through-going, a joint rupture. and when their stress levels differ significantly. For instance, the rupture tends to stop at the junction. But right now, as we've seen in our study, that you know both faults are highly stressed and their stress levels are converging, which you know is the pattern we associate with joint ruptures. So it is concerning.
This notion of earthquake gates and faults essentially kind of communicating with each other, propagating from one fault to the next, is very interesting and current because the northern terminus of the San Andreas Fault ends at the Mendocino Triple Junction. And there, mm-hmm. the Cascadia Subduction Zone, which is a huge earthquake fault of, you know, very scary for the Pacific Northwest, that goes. And there's been a recent study showing a connection between looking at the sediments at the bottom of the ocean, there's a connection that when one ruptures, it tends to trigger the other. So it's kind of interesting that we've got both things going on north and south on the fault system.
It is interesting and scary, you know, if you think about it. But, you know, whenever faults are approaching each other, they do interact with each other. But it also depends on what kind of rocks are present there. You know, some rocks or mountainous structures, they can act like a barrier mm-hmm. or like an absorbing bumper of some sort, you know.
Interesting. Tell us about the number of fault segments in your study and how many earthquakes going back, you know, how long are included in your data that you inputted into this computer model?
So we model 1,000 years of earthquake history that we got from the USGS through their studies. And it's dozens of earthquakes over, you know, our study region is 17 segments, I believe. But the whole greater region, to actually get a better picture of the stress levels, is 38 segments that we have.
Wow. And so this is going back 1,000 years of earthquakes. And I looked at the data. It was interesting, you know, talking about the gate aspect of this, that there seemed to be kind of patterns where there would be, you know, earthquakes series where the San Jacinto Fault would rupture and the San Andreas, or, you know, one or the other. And it was very interesting to look at that. Did you notice any, did your computer program notice any kind of a pattern to this?
Well, you know, we looked at how the stress levels on the three segments that are intersecting at Cajon Pass interact with each other and how their levels sort of correlate with each other. And there is a little bit of a pattern. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these earthquake dates, they do have uncertainty. So we actually also modeled in our study a second timeline, so to say, where we pulled the earthquake dates a bit closer together to each other, within each of their uncertainty as well. So in that model, we actually have more than one through-going rupture, because in the maximum rupture model, in the actual timeline that we have, there's only the one that we know, which is 1812, and that was the one involving all three segments at Cajon Pass. But in that other chronology, we modeled three of them, and then you see a bit of a better pattern of what the stress levels could be and how they would interact with each other, rupturing together.
And this would be a good time, I think, to talk about, because I know just looking at comments people make when they look at a story mm-hmm. about, for example, your study. I saw mm-hmm. one person which, you know, when I read it, it made me angry, but I was like, you know, that's kind of typical. People don't know what they're talking about and decide they're going to chime in, saying, well, you know, they didn't, this is just a computer model, and, you know, they don't even know. Not understanding, you know, nobody was here for those earthquakes. They don't know anything about it. It's like, let's talk about how we do know about these ancient quakes that we weren't around for. But there is a way to learn about them, isn't there? It's called paleoseismology. Tell us a bit about, you know, how that works and why it's important to studies like yours.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, my co-author, Kate Scar from the USGS, she has spent a lot of time trenching and, you know, digging and actually, you know, looking at this and coming up with these dates. So a few methods that you use, for instance, is carbon dating, or radiocarbon dating, which is we use to determine the age of once living material, like wood or charcoal or bone or shells or plant remains. And so that's a method that we use because carbon-14 is radioactive and we know how it decays over time. So we can actually use that to whatever we find in the sediments to then date and estimate how long ago these organisms died. And other things, you know, are tree ring records, for instance, because trees record all kinds of things, you know, stresses that happen to them and other things. And it's a good record to look at as well. And then, of course, you know, other displacements that you find in sediments that you can then date. And so these are a few of those methods that they apply. I'm not in the field doing these things, but I have a lot of faith in our colleagues at the USGS that provide us with these dates.
A really interesting paleoseismology tool that I found just kind of, wow, that's interesting. Because we're kind of thinking about California right now and what it was like 250 years ago when America was born. And back, you know, 250 years ago and 500 years ago, there were no European plants here in California. It was all just the native plants. Mm-hmm. But you can also use the pollens of European plants as markers in these paleoseismology studies. Like, for example, by 1812, you know, that stuff was here from the Spanish.
Exactly. That's also one of the methods. And also another one is, you know, the Spanish had missions all along, like the San Andreas Fault as well. And monks, you know, they were very literate and wrote a lot of records. And so we also have some records of earthquakes that happened during that time they were there because they would describe the damage that it would cause on the buildings. And from that, you can also make estimates of the magnitude of these earthquakes.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And when we talk about like the stresses that have built up, let's go a bit more into detail into that. Because there's some interesting information in your study that shows, you know, what is the amount of actual stress on the fault system and how deep is it locked? How do you go about modeling that? The amount of stress on the San Andreas or the San Jacinto fault? How do you model that?
So basically, our computer model is we use a computer code called Maxwell. So that has an elastic plate overlying a viscoelastic plate, and we assign certain parameters to it, like the Young's modulus, shear modulus, and the density for each layer. And then we implement the strike slip fault, which is elements that are basically, you know, vertical screw dislocation elements in the elastic layer. And then we assign the locking depth to each of these segments that we have. And these locking depths we can derive from different measurement methods that we have. And one of the easiest is actually to see where earthquakes occur, because then you know that's the part of the fault that is locked, whereas the other underlying part is the slipping, sort of always creeping part. So that's one of the things how we can measure that.
Yeah, and one of the interesting aspects of the southern San Andreas fault is it is very locked up compared to there's parts where to the north of Los Angeles, north of Parkfield, where it's slipping along. You know, it's called the slipping zone, really, that part of the mm-hmm. fault where it creeps. It's called the creep zone. And it just, you know, creeps along. And the fault moves, you know, just so folks kind of understand what kind of motion we're talking about the rate that your fingernails grow.
Yes.
So, exactly. So if you can, you know, just kind of imagine that you don't look at your fingernails and see them moving, but you know, after a couple of weeks, you notice and you need to trim them. It's about that same rate. And over time, you know, that amount of just, you know, an inch or so a year, or a few centimeters, that adds up to where you get like, you know, 20, 30 feet where when it breaks, that's a lot. That's a lot of rock moving. That's what causes these big earthquakes.
Exactly. So these days, you know, we can measure it precisely using GPS stations, right, which can detect motions of just a few millimeters per year. So now we actually have these methods that can actually give us these very precise numbers. And we can also estimate long-term slip rates, you know, by measuring how much features like streams, channels, and river terraces and rock units have been offset by the fault. And then we can determine how old these features are.
And you're in Switzerland, obviously, but you've been in California. Tell us about you got to go on some field outings to the fault zone. Tell us about some of your experiences, what it was like for you to actually go out and, you know, put your boots on the ground out there.
You know, when I was there a while ago for a SCEC conference, that's the Southern California, or now the statewide California Earthquake Center, we went on a field trip around the Cajon Pass area, actually, and looked at all the, you know, the fault indicators that we could see. And it was just very, very interesting to see everything actually in real person, because before, you know, I just always seen it on the maps or on Google Earth or somewhere like that. And I've been to California in the Mojave Desert for, you know, field work for class, basically for field class that we had. And during our bachelor's, we had our field camp there. So we camped out for a while in the Mojave Desert, so that, you know, I haven't had much chance to actually see the San Andreas Fault up close, like, you know, with the people from SCEC and actually explaining a lot of where the fault is located and actually looking at that in the field on the ground. It's quite different than just looking at satellite data.
Sure. And, you know, just because you live, you know, right next to the fault, it doesn't mean that the shaking's going to be really that much more than, you know, you it depends on the soil type you're on. You know, if you're on
exactly,
rock, on bedrock, your house is probably going to be okay. But if you're, you know, a few miles away from there, farther from the fault, and you're sitting on alluvial soils that are loosely consolidated, that's going to shake like jelly and go through, you know, possible liquefaction. Your house might not fare well at all. So a lot of times it's like, just because you're right next to the fault doesn't mean it's, you know, that much more dangerous. Although, if it's always been kind of my fantasy would be like, what would it look like? Let's say, you know, Lillian, we could have a drone where we've got a drone flying over, and it's always over the fault, infrared at night. We've got a day and night drone air force flying over the fault. Wouldn't it be interesting to see what a rupture actually looks like in real time?
You know, there's a video of that rupture that happened, the large strikes that
New
fault
Zealand?
Rupture. I know, in where was it? In Indonesia?
Indonesia,
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
No, next to Thailand.
Yeah.
Sorry,
okay.
I forgot.
Yeah, I think I've
but
seen...
But there's a video of that, actually. And it's the first time they've actually captured a strike slip fault in action, so to say, on video. And it's very, you know, you see the fault moving and you see how this... It's a parking structure that you see, and then like a gate outside, and you see how the tree outside the gate just moves in one big motion.
You know,
just so far, and it's the Earth is powerful, you know.
It is. And it moves. And well, but I want to see the big one, Lillian. I want to see the big rupture on the San Andreas Fault. I want to know it, because from all accounts that I've seen, that will happen so fast that it will be like traveling at the speed of a high-speed jet. It would be almost like a blur, you know. You probably need to slow it way down just to even really understand what you're seeing.
Well, I think we actually will see it, you know, because now people have so many cameras.
Yes, that's true.
Everywhere.
That's true.
And so, like, you know, observation or, you know, security cameras.
All the wildfire cameras.
We're going to capture that. We're going to capture it somehow, you know.
And, okay, well, let's talk about the probabilities of this, because, you know, I'm sure there's also folks out there that's like, yeah, you know, you guys have been talking about this for years, but not, you know, nothing's ever happened.
Well, so our study doesn't really do a probability, but the USGS does probabilities. But at its core, probability comes from counting outcomes, you know, so people have to realize that. And there are uncertainties in all of our measurements, of course. And, but, you know, if you flip a coin, many times. About half of the flips will be heads. And so we can say the probability of heads is like 50%. And in earthquake science, like we don't have thousands of identical Earths to observe. So we use the earthquake records, geological evidence and fault slip rates and so on to estimate how often certain events have occurred in the past and how likely they are to occur in the future. And so probability is our way of describing uncertainty. And the USGS actually says, you know, that in within the next 30 years, the probability of a magnitude 7 plus earthquake in Southern California is 75%.
Wow.
So that's quite high.
75%. You better be prepared. If you live anywhere near the San Andreas Fault, you better have all of your emergency supplies ready. Because, like, you know, it's not... It's as Lucy Jones, the great seismologist from the USGS in Pasadena, who's kind of the matron queen of seismology now in Southern California, as she likes to say, you know, it's not really the earthquake that's going to be the big problem. It, you know, will there be some deaths from the earthquake? Yeah, there will, unfortunately, but probably, you know, as many people are killed in Southern California from various causes in a typical year, you know, anyway. So it's not that, it's going to be the aftermath of, you know, as we mentioned, the Cajon Pass being just one spot where you've severed your infrastructure. So now you don't have water, you don't have power. And that could go on for a long period of time in a major earthquake.
Exactly. So that's, you know, concerning. And the real message is, you know, have a plan, have supplies, you know what to do when the communication goes down. You know, how do you communicate with your family, your friends? Are you going to meet up someplace? Did you, you know, set a place where you're going to meet up? Does everyone know? And just have a plan.
Yeah, one of the things I love about my business, which is essentially radio, is that in a big disaster, a lot of times, you know, we've become so dependent on our cellular communications network that cell towers and things can go down and suddenly you don't have access to your network. But radio will still work and you'll still be able to get emergency information through the emergency broadcast system, through just radio stations providing that. So that would be another thing that I think most people... Even though nowadays they think, oh, radio isn't that quaint. That's so old-fashioned. You should have one. You should have one in your emergency kit.
Yeah. Yeah. You should have one of those hand-cranked little radios, you know, the ones that you can buy for, like, emergency kits. You should have one of those for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Well, going back to your study, when you finished this and published it, were there any big, like, for you and your colleagues, were there any big surprises to you as you, you know, came to these conclusions? Was there anything that, you know, really surprised you guys?
Well, guess we went into the study expecting, like, the overall individual high stress levels to matter, which is a theory, right? And somewhat the foundation of stress modeling. But what we didn't fully anticipate was how similarly elevated stress between fault segments mattered, and not specifically the highest individual peaks. You know, we see that the history shows that joint ruptures crossing Cajon Pass occurred when the two fault systems were carrying similarly elevated stress at the same time. So it's not just about how much stress has built up, but also how these faults are in sync with each other. And somehow that's, you know, that's more nuanced in some way and also a more actionable finding because it gives us a condition to watch for rather than just like a absolute threshold or something.
Yes. And I would be remiss if we didn't also tell us about the other members of your team.
Well, the other members of our team are, you know, of course, my PhD advisor, Bridget Smith-Conter, and Kate Scar from the USGS, and David Sandwell from Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which was actually Bridget's PhD advisor.
And when you work on a study together with people like that, how do you go about it? Do you guys meet on Zoom? Do you get together? Does everybody do their individual part of the, you know, here's my part, and then you all just share? How does that work?
Well, we all do our individual parts and then share, but we also, you know, you have meetings, especially with Kate, of course, from the USGS, because she provided the 1,000 years of earthquake history to us and explained, you know, how they got these dates and how we would integrate these dates, and also, you know, constructing this alternative timeline as well for us to look at the stress levels there. And so we had a lot of email exchange and meetings as well online on Zoom mostly, because a lot of this was done during the pandemic as well. But I've also been to Scripps myself and met Dave there. And because, you know, this research goes back so far with this model being developed, you know, in the early 2000s, even before.
Right.
So, and then we're just taking it now to another level because we have way better data that we can put in more precise measurements and also developing the computer code further, you know.
And this study did get a lot of attention from the media. It was kind of interesting, as everywhere I looked, all of a sudden it was like, you know, TV stations in Southern California doing stories about it, newspapers, you know, your usual clickbait things on the internet. Were you surprised by the attention this got?
Well, you know, we sort of knew maybe that it could gather some attention, but not in this, you know, in this magnitude really at all. So it was kind of surprising, but you know, it's a news cycle and it depends what's on the news that day or that week and how journalists react to this. But you know, the San Andreas is home to millions of people living nearby. So of course this is going to gather some attention. We knew that.
Absolutely. And I think it's a very good reminder for people to be prepared, because even though it's kind of nice just to think, well, you know, it could happen in 5 minutes. My shake alert could go off. You know, it could happen. It happened this morning. It wasn't a big earthquake, but there was an earthquake not far from me, and I didn't feel anything. But there it was.
Exactly.
There it was. It could happen 5 minutes from now, or it could be another 30 years. You just don't know. So that's you know, when you take out insurance and things like that, you're looking at the big picture and the long term and planning for that.
Exactly. Be prepared rather than alarmed, because the risk is real, and the risk has been there for a while, and it will be, you know, even more so as we go on without having a rupture, because the stress is building up over time. You know, so that's just how this goes.
Yeah,
but it's not a prediction tool. I have to emphasize
yes.
that we are identifying conditions that could lead to rupture, but it's not a prediction tool. But we know with certainty that the San Andreas Fault will rupture again in the future.
Yes. Anytime anybody asks me about that, when they say, oh, I saw a prediction, blah, 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 that the San Andreas, but, you know, in the next few days or whatever, I tell them that is just garbage. Nobody can predict earthquakes. There's no way to do that. And one of the things that is very frightening about earthquakes is you can't predict them. We're very fortunate now in California and other parts of the world to have these seismic networks that can alert us when there is a rupture. The first waves, the P waves, the primary waves, trigger that shake alert system. And it has to make a very quick decision on how big an area to alert people and to be ready for shaking. And so it will do that, like it did this morning on mine, whether it's, you know, needed or not. It's still a valuable tool, because in that event, that at least gives you, you know, 30 seconds, maybe a minute to get ready for that heavy shaking, to get yourself to a safe place to drop and cover. So that's another tool that we have now that we didn't have 30 years ago.
Exactly. And it's a very, very useful tool. You know, if you're operating heavy machinery or something,
yes.
just a few seconds can give you that, you know, can give you that chance to actually, you know, have a chance and let go of whatever you're doing or cover and, you know, and yeah.
Or you're a surgeon in the midst of an operation or something, you know,
exactly.
something like
yes.
that. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, you need to... You need to have that alert system go off, and it is a powerful new tool that we have. Before we let you go, you're such an interesting person with all these fascinating aspects to you. What have you got planned for the future? Any interesting projects you're working on? You know, that are upcoming.
Well, right now, you know, I'm working and more on the planetary side, so. I'm an instrument scientist for BELA, which is the laser altimetry instrument aboard the EpiColombo mission. That's a European Space Agency mission on its way to Mercury. And we'll have orbit insertion at Mercury this November. It's planned for November 21st, actually. So that's exciting for us. And that instrument was built at the University of Bern. That's why I'm there right now. So that's coming up. And I'm also the co-I on GALA, which is the laser altimeter aboard the JUICE mission going to Ganymede. But that won't arrive until the 2030s. So, but still, those are the projects I have lined up right now. But we also have another study on the San Andreas Fault coming up that's been submitted to BSSA. That's the Bulletin of the Seismological Society of America. So where we look at some other segments as well.
Can you tell us, because I know a lot of times that stuff's proprietary and you can't tell anybody about it till it's actually published. But can you give us a sense, is it about different segments from the ones in this study?
It's from segments a bit further south as well. Okay. And a bit more north. But especially, I can tell you that, it's one of them is the Coachella segment. Ooh. And when you look at the Coachella segment, you know, you see that it hasn't ruptured in quite a while.
Yes.
So, and I can tell you that actually since 1726. And it used to rupture quite frequently before that in kind of an interval. And I can tell you that stresses are very high on that segment right now. So it's quite concerning.
Yes, it's just, it makes me wonder why that southern section, which has ruptured, you know, big time in the past, has been so quiet for so long. It's strange.
Yes, we can, you know, we can only speculate really why that is. And look at the conditions ever since, you know, maybe the behavior of the fault has somewhat changed or something. But, you know, you also have to realize a lot of people moved into the area.
Yes.
And they're pumping out water. And, you know, during the Second World War, there was a lot of oil coming out of the ground. And there still is to some degree. So also changes in pore pressures can cause a fault system to change its behavior a bit.
Hmm. Yeah, you're taking away some of that lubrication from, you know, from all those fluids down in the crust. That's interesting. And then another kind of cool thing to do, if you look at Google Maps, Earth, or you're just driving along in Coachella Valley and, you know, you can kind of spot where the fault is because you'll see these strips of green palm trees, oases with springs. And guess what? That's where the fault is.
Yep.
Well, Lillianne Burkhart, it's been just a lot of fun to talk to you and find out about your work and this interesting study on the Southern San Andreas Fault and the gateway concept there at the Cajon Pass. I imagine, you know, for folks that might listen to this driving through there, they'll think about it every time they drive through there on 210.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to our guest, planetary scientist Lillianne Burkhart from the University of Bern in Switzerland. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.